Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is the National Progressive Radio Network, and this is Denise Nichols hosting the hour-long program today. Doug Roeke had a personal commitment with his family, so I am hosting the program today. And this is going to be a program on Gulf War illness. First of all, I'd like to say hello to all of our Gulf War veterans and their family members and tell them to hold on to hope. There is hope coming with claims work being elevated in importance, that if you've been fighting your claim, hopefully there's going to be some headway made shortly for you. We're hearing more and more of their claims coming through. So you got to hold on to hope on that. We've got to hold on to hope that with the researchers and the research effort that we will find a method of treatment to help our quality of life. And that's how I'd like to start out our program today, is just an update. We just finished with the Senate side. We started with the House side to get appropriations for our DOD, that's Department of Defense, appropriations to the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program for fiscal year 2014. They start, the year before to get that funding. And what happens, and to explain it to everybody, is that we usually have leaders on the House side and the Senate side that draft a letter, and they circulate it to their fellow colleagues, their fellow representatives are on the Senate side, the senators, and they ask them to join with them by signing onto that letter. It's a brief letter requesting assistance in the appropriations process to fund the Gulf War Illness Research Program at the DOD CDMRP. And it usually starts in the House, which we did. And this year we gained 66 to sign on to that effort out of 435 members of the House of Representatives. Then we had a couple of weeks off. We thought we'd have a little longer, but then all of a sudden we were hit with the senator's letter, Senator Sanders' letter, duplicating the process that we do on the House side to get us funding. Again, it is a letter to get their fellow members to sign on with them, and then the letter goes to the Appropriations Committee, and it would go to the subcommittee that deals with defense issues. So when we ask for people to call and help us, we're asking, number one, you got to call the D.C. office, not the home office. The D.C. office of the representatives or the senators are the ones that deal with the laws, the funding issues, policy issues, all that. So that's why you center your calls to those offices in D.C. and not the home office. And when we're really short of notice, and even when we're not, we call on you to make the phone calls because we need to bring it to the top of their stack. Like in the DOD program, there's at least 25 research programs over there, from cancers to various illnesses. We're just one of them. But we are one that doesn't have true mechanisms of diagnosis by diagnostic studies or by blood work, or, you know, treatment. So we should be a priority besides being basically war veterans. And it's not just the Gulf War vets, it's also Iraq and Afghanistan vets. And we had quite a hill to climb. And we've climbed it for 22 years with roadblocks, DOD, not saying the exposures, fighting to get the comity of bunkers out there of what happened, and the exposures that were all the potentials. And then, you know, we've had to go to the VA. The VA funding was always directed toward stress, and we have battled them. And in 2005, we started this process, getting funding through the Congressionally Directed Medical Research to really get keyed in on the physical effects and to find a treatment. So we have battled each year to get that funded. And that's what we were doing. This is the kickoff, as you call it. You gather up your team, you make the phone calls, you get to the right person. And when we're talking about a probes issue from DOD, you need to talk to the defense staffer. Well, we got our notification that the Senate letter had gone out, and we had roughly a little over 48 hours to work, get in touch with each of these offices, talk to their defense staffer. And out of that effort, it was kind of sad this year. Last year, I think we had 16. This year, we only got 6. We had limited time. We were calling on people to help. This happens annually that we're going to need those help with phone calls. We have 435 reps, 100 senators, so that's a lot of phone calling to make. We ask that you for sure contact your elected representative or your elected senators from your state. If you have time, we'd like you to reach out and try to hit the others too. So this was a huge effort that we go through every year. Yes, we're disappointed that we didn't get more signatures on the Senate side. Last year, I think we had 16. We've gained each year in the House. It means getting the right people on the phone, updating them quickly, and getting their interest to take it to their boss and to get them to sign on. At the same time, you have to realize that there's other programs sending the same type letters out to get their attention, to get their sign-ons. And in this day and time, with money being a critical issue, it means it's even more important that we get involved. So that's what the process was that we just completed. Now it goes into the Defense Appropriations Committees to work on. And then we'll see it come out several months later of how much we are going to get. And if we don't get anything, you have to go to, when they go to floor action, it has to be brought up by amendment. Or if they've cut us too short with the amount of money they do propose, then we have to have an amendment to fight to get increased funding. So that's how it works on the Hill on that issue. And it's a hard thing to do every year. I'm busy every day making phone calls when that happens. I'm going to encourage veterans and family members that you need to keep in touch with those people throughout the year. When we have research, our news articles talking about the research and the findings, we need to be emailing them and keeping them directly informed. And a phone call, maybe once a quarter, just to update them on significant material. Because usually the staffers are there for at least a couple of years on the House side. Some of them stay with us a long, long time. So there are key people to keep them informed and keep them updated. So I think one of the things we need to do is up that effort of continually updating them so that it's not a once-a-year process. The other thing is that we need to be aware of other bills. And one that I'd like to point out is our bill for a national memorial for the Gulf War period of time. For the National Desert Storm and Desert Shield War Memorial Act, which is gaining co-sponsors on the House side, that's H.R. 503. So that's another reason to email them, call them. There is a listing that I've put out on Facebook of the 36 that have signed on so far out of 435 and what state they're in so that you can know if they signed on. Certainly drop them a letter, an email, you know, call them, thank them for that effort. If they haven't, you bring it up. All you have to do is call them, tell them the bill number, talk to them about the need for it. And, you know, if they've looked at the bill, if they've brought it up to their boss to sign on as a co-sponsor. So I wanted to bring that up again, that we have that. It's not the first year that we've been working on this. It's been reintroduced by Congressman Roe of Tennessee. And now he's got 36 co-sponsors. I think we can do a lot better on that. Now, one of the things that I wanted to mention today and work on, and I have a couple of call-ins to be guests, and we'll probably have one or two other call-ins. You're welcome to call in with your questions. But what we want to talk about is a critical issue of Gulf War veterans having pulmonary embolus. Many of you know that I was involved in getting us a study independently done in 99 that we started. And it was with David Berg, Dr. Hannah, a great deal of us got involved. I kind of recognized the symptom that we had, our bleeding gums, nosebleeds, the females with uncontrollable cycles, menstrual cycles. We had people with blood in the urine, blood in the stool. And having been an old ICU nurse, I said, this is something else besides the brain damage that we're looking at. So we've had an independent study done that was published in the Journal of Coagulation and Fibrinosis, November of 2000. Since then, we had one of the reviewers of our peer-reviewed article get involved to carry this forward, and that's Ron Bach in Minneapolis, and he's working on finishing up his work and publishing his study on hypercoagulation. And what that means is that we have very thickened blood, more subject to blood clots. And if you think about that, the blood system is a huge organ in our body, effectively, that carries the blood. It supplies all the organs. Now, if you have thick blood from, we feel it's an inflammatory process, then you're going to have other problems like stroke, heart attacks, possibly deep vein thrombosis, and the big one, pulmonary embolus. Not saying that heart attack is less of importance, and we may have a call-in talking about that. But I have two Gulf War vets that in the last year have had pulmonary embolus. And this is a life-threatening situation that I felt like we needed to bring it up in the radio program and spend some time talking to them about their experiences and the symptoms they had and what occurred to them. Now, the first one I think is on the line now is Peter Green. Peter, are you with us?
Hi, Denise. I'm here. Thank you for having me on.
Peter served in the 101st as an Aeroscout helicopter pilot with B Troop 217th Air Cav. And he just got out of the hospital just lately. And his age right now is 53. Subtract about 22 years from that. Was much younger then, right, Peter?
Definitely. Just turned 30 while I was in Iraq.
Right. And you just had a pulmonary embolus. Would you tell us some of your other health problems before this happened?
Well, since my time in theater, I've been dealing with chronic migraines, which are very debilitating, of course, and they really do not respond to any medical kind of treatment. I have what my doctors call widespread chronic pain syndrome, which is their way of saying that they don't have any idea what's causing the pain around my body. I also suffer from IBS, gastric reflux. The list goes on, but those are probably some of the biggest medical problems that I have to deal with.
Okay. Can you tell us what led up and what happened that you ended up going to the hospital?
Well, it started on a Friday afternoon, and for no reason whatsoever, I started coughing. I didn't think too much of it. I thought maybe I'd gotten a bug. Over the weekend, the coughing became very violent. My chest started hurting. The muscles in my back from the violent coughing went into spasms. And then finally on Sunday night, I came down with fever. The fever was the thing that fortunately pushed me over the edge. The next morning I went up and went to the emergency room thinking that I was probably just going to walk in, get a shot with some antibiotics, and get sent home with a prescription. What I did find was that by the time I got to the ER, I could barely breathe, could barely stand up, and the ER staff went absolutely crazy. I've never seen them move so fast, and I seriously have to give them major thanks for reacting the way they did, because they probably saved my life.
Well, let's name the facility you were at that did that.
That was the Portland Veterans Administration, or the Portland VA Hospital.
Kudos out to the Portland VA emergency room for really paying attention and getting right on and saving one of our Gulf War veterans. Go ahead now, Peter.
Yeah, they were right on top of it. I was pretty amazed, extremely grateful. I did not realize the gravity of my situation even after they told me what I had. They had simply told me that I had blood clots in my lungs and that they were going to admit me. It wasn't until several days later when I had enough function to actually look up and ask the right questions that I realized how closely I came to actually dying. It was really eye-opening and quite frankly, pretty scary.
Would you tell us where your blood clots were at?
I had, in this case, I was fortunate to some respect that I had smaller blood clots in both my lungs, on the lower left part of my lung and in the lower right and the center part of my right lung. I also had what's called a pleural effusion in my left lung, which meant there was fluid in my lungs, very similar to what happens when we have pneumonia.
Right. When you have clots and that happens, that is not unusual because your blood's not circulating, fluids don't move like they're supposed to, oxygen doesn't move. Did you have clear thoughts at the time? Were you thinking as clearly as normal as you were going through that?
No, absolutely not. I came to found out after I'd gotten up on the floor why the ER staff had became so concerned was that they were telling them my blood fat levels were below 80, which meant I was hypoxic. I wasn't getting enough oxygen in my brain. And to be honest, that whole first day, it was just a blur. Normally, they want our blood fat, oxygen saturation levels on our blood at 95 or higher.
Right.
So I was in a pretty bad way.
So your thinking process was probably affected. You were probably very fuzzy in knowing what was going on, really.
Absolutely. And really, the only thing that I can remember from that first 24 hours is the pain. I can tell you that when you have lung tissue dying, it is a very painful event.
Okay. Is Scott with us yet?
Yes.
Scott also went through a pulmonary embolus, and Scott was over in the Gulf War. He was following the Big Red One as a maintenance technician and was all over the place in Log Base Alpha and Echo and up into Iraq. And he was with the 1073rd maintenance out of Michigan, a guard unit, activated Army Guard. So Scott's another one that's one of our miracles. And Scott, would you tell them some of your symptoms that you've been dealing with before this happened to you?
Before this happened, it happened in May. Earlier in the month, what I had was a bloody diarrhea attack, which was surprising, just came out of the blue. I didn't think nothing of it. Went to the doctor. They said they couldn't figure out what was going on. And then this is like on the 4th of May. On the 21st of May, I was out training for OCS because I'm still in the National Guard. And I was getting ready to run a long distance. I think it was a half marathon. And walking, all of a sudden my calf just felt tight. I stopped and stretched it, and all of a sudden I lost my breath. So I called the doctor. I made an appointment, went into the doctor on a Monday, and they did an EKG, and they ran some lab work and did a chest x-ray. Told me everything was okay. Well, on Thursday, on the 24th, I ended up passing out in a restaurant, just walking in the doors, and the ambulance had to bring me into the hospital. I really had no symptoms besides just the feeling of malaise. And they did the same test the doctor's office did. It was the addition of a CT scan with contrast, and they came out and told me I had a fatal pulmonary embolism seen in the lateral aspects of the bilateral main pulmonary arteries. And I also had large embolism in both lungs.
Okay. So your symptoms started with leg pain, correct?
Just not really pain. It's just like when you're running, how you get a tight calf.
Yes.
That's all it was. It was no pain, no swelling, no redness, no nothing.
And I want to take a second to remember our Bloom Mobile in the Iraq invasion. And those that watched it on TV, and I know that myself and another Navy nurse that was Vietnam and Gulf War, were just in horror as we watched, and he was, you know, following the convoy and all the sand all over him. And we were screaming and yelling at the time, get him some mask, you know, commercial grade for like painters to filter out the sand. And David Bloom ended up having a deep vein thrombosis that broke off and then went to his lung. And that's what he died of. It was a pulmonary embolus that started with the deep vein. And he died there in theater. Plus the lack of movement as they were convoying kind of increased it, because they can't move around as much if they're traveling by vehicle and in a convoy. So, you know, he died of it. And it's been all this time that I have been, as the old ICU nurse, just horrified by what I was seeing in our Gulf War vets, and to know that the possible repeating would happen with our current veterans. So I want to say this is a deadly, deadly problem, and it needs to be paid attention to, people. And that's why I'm having people come on the air today and talk about their experience and their symptoms. So, Scott, back to you. They saw it on the CT scan. And did they do an oxygen saturation at that time?
I don't remember what it was at the time. I was kind of out of it. I guess I was really hypoxic. But I did pass out, so I can imagine it was in the 80s. Slowly as they put me on a non-rebreather, which is a big oxygen mask, I started coming to a little bit more. But I'm imagining it was quite low.
Yeah, they have to be very aggressive and identify the problem, get you on oxygen, get the IV in, and usually heparin IV.
They ended up giving me TPA.
TPA on yours, okay. Well, you had a larger block. You had a saddle pulmonary embolus, so you are truly a miracle child, I keep telling you. A miracle person. Changed the terminology.
Thank God every day.
And to have survived that and had gone to the doctor on the Monday, and then you ended up in the hospital that day?
I ended up in the hospital, and it was on a Monday, and Thursday I ended up passing out and getting into the hospital.
Right, so they didn't pick it up at the doctor's office of what the true problem was.
No, so that's why it's very important that if anybody has any kind of pain like that, they get to the ER, get that CT scan. The doctors are not going to do a CT scan in their office. They may have x-ray equipment, they might have lab equipment and their EKG capabilities, but they missed it using that.
So I think, you know, what we have to point out is the symptoms, clearly, of what each of you had, and that you lost consciousness. And that, you know, if you get into the ER, that's what's important, is right into the ER. Get the oxygen saturation. That's the first clue they will have that there's something wrong. And then they're going to, you know, get the CAT scans done quickly. And, you know, in the meantime, I'm sure they had you on oxygen and an IV started in deciding which course to take after that. Tell us about the pain, both of you. What was the pain like? How you can describe it to others so if they have these things, they can quickly know that they need to get to the ER. Scott, you first.
All right. Like I said earlier, the pain in my calf was just like a pulled calf muscle, like runners get. And I really had no other pain besides that. That's the scary thing. Now, when the TPA hit the blood clot, the pain went through the roof. I don't understand why it wasn't that way before that, but I'm still dealing with pain in the leg now.
And are you on, what therapy are you on after you left the hospital?
I am on Humulin therapy right now.
Okay. And Peter, are you on Humulin or...
Yeah, I'm on Coumadin for a minimum of 6 months.
Right. And
one thing also, on the Coumadin, I found out later on that Coumadin can actually mess with the your eyes too. I had an eye doctor appointment in addition to what's going on, and they said I'm getting clouding in my eyes now.
Right. And that is important to point out. I think on your Facebook page that we started after I talked to you, that we started a page on pulmonary embolism, there is a person there that's lost vision in his eye, and there was a blood clot. So, you know, he's lucky that, you know, in one way that it wasn't a pulmonary embolus that got him, and maybe he might have lost his life, but he's lost vision now. So it is important to recognize the other symptoms may be a change in vision in one or both eyes. It could be, you know, also a stroke. And if you're thinking a stroke, you want to, the thing you need to know, are you moving your arms and legs, you know, gripping somebody's hand? Is it equal left and right? Are you able to smile and either look in a mirror or have somebody look at you to see if the smile is equal on the left and right side? Are you able to talk and pronounce your words? Those are symptoms of stroke, which means that the clot has gone to the brain. And you either have a clot up there or you have, you know, ruptured a blood vessel or had a clot in your carotid arteries. So those are other symptoms you need to watch for. Now, with the pain, Peter, you had the coughing. Did you feel any gagging? Did you feel like you were getting enough air? Were you gasping for air?
I was, particularly towards the end, on the end of the third day. I went into coughing fits, and I was probably pretty close to passing out like Scott was. I was getting gray during these coughing fits because I absolutely wasn't breathing enough at all. Unlike Scott, I didn't have any other signs. It sounds like he might have had a deep vein thrombosis. It's probably important to other Gulf War veterans to note that my doctors still have no idea why these pulmonary embolisms happened to me. They had no idea whatsoever. They've thrown up their hands, and that was all they could tell me.
Yeah. Did either of you have bleeding gums? Are the nosebleeds?
No, I didn't have any bleeding.
Okay, no bleeding. Okay. And you had chest pain after the fact, and that was from the lungs, and trying to breathe is going to create pain.
I didn't have any pain until the TPA.
Right. So you had
that pain is very, very, for me, it was very sharp every breath. It was like somebody was sticking knives into my chest, and breathing became my main focus. It was just an incredibly horrid experience to go through.
Well, I'm putting this out on the radio because a lot of times, you know, when this happens to the person it's happening to, if you don't have good oxygenation, your brain is not going to be functioning. Because it's not getting the oxygen. You're going to be fuzzy. You're not going to be thinking as clearly. And it's going to take people around you to kind of say, whoa, we're in trouble, and get you to the hospital. So this is another thing to teach family members and people you're working around about what happens when you have a situation like this, so they can recognize it and help you and get you to the ER. Calling 911 is the best way, because you can't just count on loading somebody in your car and getting them to the ER. What if they go down while they're in the car on you? They're not getting oxygen support. They're not getting an IV started. So it's always better to call the ambulance.
And yeah, I work as an EMT, and I was in denial for those days, too. And I don't know if that's just due to stubbornness or what, but if I'm an EMT and I'm listed on myself, this is a very difficult thing for doctors and other people to diagnose without those scans. without getting a CT scan. So the emergency room is probably, anybody who loses their breath just for a second, or just out of the blue for a second, and it keeps persisting, getting worse, you need to get in.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if Kathleen has called in to join us, one of our other female veterans, but she's had cardiac problems, significantly so. And so, you know, we're talking about pulmonary embolism, but it could be a stroke. It could be deep vein thrombosis that you need to pay attention to before it progresses somewhere else. It could be the cardiac problem. And having, you know, lived through that 3 years ago with my husband having a cardiac, and having been a cardiac nurse. But, you know, when you're in the ICU or on the hospital floor dealing with a cardiac patient, they're already identified. You know what you're dealing with. But for family members at home, you got to watch a person. And with gut flora vets, it's particularly hard because we have the fatigue that we're already dealing with. The fatigue may be one of the key first signs, is that their activity is not the same as it was. It's changing. The coloration. And, you know, if you're watching a person and, you know, you're married, whatever, watch their coloration. If they're getting paler than normal, if they're getting a gray tone, especially around the face or the ears or the lips, there is something going on. The oxygenation is not right. And so, you know, you need to get them assessed by the ER. And we lost a friend that knew about my husband, who was also a Vietnam vet, and he knew about what my husband had gone through. I'd seen him at a function, and had talked to him about, you know, my husband's symptoms and what I'd noticed and what I kicked myself in the butt for not, you know, making him go to the ER or to the doctor sooner. And, you know, so he knew the subtle symptoms that I'd seen that we just hadn't put together. And he was, you know, very busy. He was pilot, and he was out in California, and he had a doctor's appointment. He canceled it for whatever reason. He was out in the hotel, and he went to bed that night and didn't wake up. He was gone to us. And he had so many more years of life. He had just gotten remarried, had three teenage daughters by the new marriage. And this can happen, and people need to have kind of a health alert out there. And so that's the reason I chose to focus on this problem today, particularly for our Gulf War vets, because we've had too many of them that we read their obituaries, and they die suddenly at home. Well, I think the Gulf War vets, and as much research as I've done calling and checking what's the cause of death, if I can find out or get in touch with the family, it isn't been suicide. It's not suicide for this group. It's been car accidents, it's been cancers, heart attacks, you know, died at home, and if they had an autopsy to find that they had a pulmonary embolus or what. But I felt the need to get the word out very clearly. And Scott, you work with EMTs and you're headed to going into nursing.
Congratulations. I'm a paramedic first, and then I'm going to get into the nursing, yes.
So, you know, I look to you to help sound that alarm. We've set up Facebook pages on it. But what is some more things that you would want to get out to the public, both of you? And I guess we'll go with Peter first. Peter, you're non-medical, but you were a pilot.
Right.
So what would you have to say about sounding the alert out there?
Well, a couple of different things come to mind. And one of the things that, and why I consider myself lucky to have lived through this process, according to the CDC, the first sign for 25% of people who suffer from pulmonary embolisms is sudden death. And that, you know, makes us, Scott and I, part of that three-fourths that missed that and made it through. The other thing that, and you mentioned it briefly earlier, was the work that Dr. Bach has been doing up in Minneapolis about inflammation.
I became greatly concerned with that and contacted him with that about my episode, and it was his educated opinion that it could very likely be from inflammation, which is what he thinks is the underlying symptom-causing process in Gulf War illness.
Right. There is, from our initial study back in 99-2000, there is a commercial test available now through Esoteric Labs. And I want people to know about that because it will look at the hypercoagulation using what they call an ISAC panel. And it's an immune-stimulating situation that's occurring going along with the inflammation. And there is a commercial test out there. And if anybody contacts me at Denise Nichols on Facebook or dsnurse1@yahoo.com or Denise or dsnurse@aol.com, I'll provide you that information, particularly for our Gulf War vets, that it might behoove you to push and get this commercial test done, because we are finding that in research that there is a problem, and this may give you a heads up that you have a problem. So that's an Esoteric Lab. You can look up Esoteric and look for the coagulation studies that they have available, and it's an ISAC panel test. So I wanted to get that word out there widely, and one of the ways through the radio program that we do every week. Neither of you had that work done, and all of a sudden you were hit with this, and miracle, you are alive. Are there other things that you would like to say to the audience today and other Gulf War vets that may be listening or their family members? Scott, I'll let you have a word here.
I think being able to recognize what's going on and educating yourself is probably the best way to prevent this. If you feel, you know, just go in and get stuff checked out. You're not feeling right. And just the sudden loss of breath is what you really got to be concerned with the pulmonary embolism. That should be a first clue. If your calf is swelling up or your forearm is swelling up, some part of your body is swelling up, that's a sign of a deep vein thrombosis. And that is another clue, discoloration around your calves and your forearms. You need to be aware of this stuff so you can be proactive.
Yeah, you know, we're finding a lot of the brain damage. The recent studies that came out from Georgetown that I participated in, know Dr. Berenick at Georgetown. Right now, there's not a whole lot we can do with the brain studies that have been done by Dr. Haley or Dr. Sullivan or Dr. Bronick, but the inflammatory process that may be, you know, a key here, and having something to key into that can make a difference in your life. And the blood work, you know, keeping track of your blood work, keeping track of pains that you have or swelling, very important. You brought up some good points, Scott. What else, Scott?
No, I just want to be clear, correct me if I'm wrong. Basically, blood clots form is inflammation is a normal process. What I don't understand is how the deep vein thrombosis was taking place or been into the lungs, because you cut yourself, your cut, it usually gets warm, swollen up, and, you know, that's the normal part of healing is through the inflammation part. But what I don't understand is how this is happening, this Gulf War veterans getting these pulmonary embolisms or heart attacks or strokes.
Well,
it's by the clot, but why is it doing it?
Okay, I'll kind of give you, you know, I mentioned the bleeding gums, the blood, the nosebleeds, the blood in the urine, blood in the stool, the uncontrollable menstrual cycles that female vets had, and they ended up having hysterectomies, or not being able to carry a child to birth. What I reflected on and what hit me when I started thinking of those symptoms was I went back to my critical care times that I worked at Wilfred Hall. And we had what at that time was fairly new, was called disseminated intravascular coagulation. And it occurred when we had infections occurring in the critical care. Now, that is the acute stage, a real acute stage. You know, you're overwhelmed with infection. I mean, we had to treat it with fresh frozen plasma and platelets and, you know, studying, following what the blood work was telling us that was missing as far as the complement factor of the blood. Now, when I noticed that we had the nosebleeds, the bleeding gums, I was going, what's going on? You know, this is kind of the symptom when you have it acutely, you're having bleeding occur outwardly as a symptom, and it's pretty apparent. And so, you know, I was sitting there going, this isn't exactly what I saw in critical care, but something's going on with the blood. And so that was my thought process when I talked to Dr. Hanna at the CDC. And interestingly enough, she knew Dr. David Berg's lab in Arizona, which was Hemex Labs. And he had done a study initially with OB patients. And you know, the problem was there with OB patients that had infections. And then he had done a study with chronic fatigue civilians and showed a problem there. And he had not looked at Guffor vets, but Dr. Hanna made the connection with him and said, we need to have a look-see. And it was truly independently funded. The lab ended up paying for the work they were doing on this study. And that was, you know, a lot of phone calling to vets that I knew had nosebleeds, the bleeding gums, and trying to recruit them and getting blood draw from a civilian lab, get it shipped overnight with dry ice so that they, you know, could look at it. And it was kind of one of those experimental small sample groups that we had to look at to say, hey, something's going on. We were very lucky. The journal that we got published in, the Journal of Coagulation and Fibrinosis, had Dr. Bach on hand, and he ended up being the reviewer, which I did not find out until I got forces to play to have him invited to speak at the RAC meeting, because I'd seen at the RAC meeting how the VA, out of all their studies that I didn't approve of them doing for the Gov4 vets focused on stress, there was this one on hypercoagulation. And as soon as I got back home to Denver, I was on the phone calling him. He never told me that he had been our reviewer on that study until I got him invited to go to Boston to tell what he was finding. And the first study was initially funded by VA. He needed more money to get a larger sampling. So then, you know, he got involved with CDMRP funding him. So he was a reviewer, and what he's done is actually much further in the game plan here of looking at what is triggering this to happen. What other biomarkers are there? So if you were in his study, and I did participate, you had to go there because he's taking that blood right into the lab, and he's looking at interleukins and, you know, the pathway that this is triggering in order to figure out what best way to treat. Now, David Berg, the other doctors that were involved with the initial study, they were recommending low-dose heparin. Now, heparin, if you do enough study and digging through the research, heparin had a unique property that even as a nurse with a master's degree and having had critical care experience, I didn't know this until I kept digging, and I finally found that it has an anti-inflammatory component. And so they were recommending, you know, the low-dose heparin. and not so much the Coumadin. But that's the whole story of kind of putting bits and pieces together and you know, triggering a thought pattern and a question pattern of, we've got to look at this. And how much of the brain damage might be due to circulation changes and blood changes? We don't have all the answers yet. But I remember pushing on Dr. Haley and saying, you know, you're looking at the brain and seeing a damage, but couldn't the blood flow, couldn't the blood circulation have an effect? So that is why we've got to keep pushing for our researchers to be funded. And I kind of want to go to a few minutes because I know Peter jumped on board, made phone calls to work with the senators and the reps. But before I go to that, did Kathleen Hennessy call in by any chance? I don't hear her. I'll have her on another day about the cardiac problems. But on the effort, Peter, you got really involved. Scott, I'm not sure if you had time to make phone calls to the reps or to the senators. And what is your feelings about that? And what could you say to family members and vets about when we put the call out to really stand up and get involved?
Well, I mean, it's very important. I mean, it's that simple. It's very important that they become involved in helping themselves. You know, we all can sit around and complain about the VA and our claims are backlogged and my doctors don't know what's going on because they don't understand anything. And it doesn't get anything done. If everybody will pick up, and just even in their own state, just call their senator's office, go to their senator's website and send a message and ask them to support these issues for Gulf War illness research, we can make a lot of headway. When there's just a handful of us calling in, it's not as big an impact. If 20 people call in to the office in one day, then somebody's going to take notice in that office, and that senator or that congressional representative is going to hear about it. So, action. We have to take some action, and we have to help ourselves, because nobody else is going to do it for us.
That's right. Peter, when you got through to him, did you tell him what you had lived through?
I did. In many letters and many phone calls, you know, I've explained that I was an ill Gulf War veteran, that my quality of life is limited because of all the problems that I have, and that I just recently had a life-threatening illness that I believe is caused by this illness. And there's research pending, of course, by Dr. Bach, and clinical trials that could shed some light on this. And that's how I tried to make them understand that this was important to me, not just as an issue, a political issue, but this was important to me as a human being, and this was threatening my life and the others that like me. I couldn't, you know, it was no effort. Well, I shouldn't say that. It was a glad effort to spend the day calling and talking to these people and asking them to help us fund this research.
Scott, were you able to have time to make phone calls, and what was your feeling on that?
Sadly, I didn't have the time because I was stuck in school because of the paramedic program I'm in and the clinicals I got to do to get to that point so I can help other people.
Okay. One of the things we like to follow up on, too, is your doctors that handled you. And, Scott, did you end up at the VA hospital also?
I ended up at Gateway Medical Center in Clarksville, Tennessee.
Okay. I think people, if you get doctors that have helped you through an episode like this, or even if you're having some symptoms, you're concerned about that, to know that Dr. Ron Bach is involved, to get in touch with me. If you're on Facebook, get in touch with Scott or Peter. We'll guide you along. But I think it's important to try to find the doctors that have dealt with these problems. And like the one online that, you know, has had a clot in the eye. We need to get these clinical doctors involved with our researchers and start to speak out. And one of the things that's hit me in my brain, and it's time-wise, was I was watching some of the coverage from the White House correspondents, you know, big dinner last night. But before that, they had like a garden party. And what hit me was they had identified the problem with epilepsy, and our Iraqi vets have had traumatic brain injury, and they develop epilepsy. And they had, you know, a captain there, Army captain, that had had a bullet wound to the head and has developed epilepsy. And he's living through it and dealing with the seizures. But he said he couldn't say too much. But what he said is, I guess I'm just too dumb not to speak out. And, you know, he started going to the Hill. And he had Representative Cantor there, a leader in the House, to speak about it. And so part of their funding for that brunch went to, number one, the Miss America Scholarship Fund, but also the Cure Epilepsy. And I think that what I saw in that brief clip was Cantor saying that we can be divided in many ways on the Hill by party, by different philosophy. But when it comes to human suffering and human need, they can come together. And I kind of want to mention that because, you know, I reflected back on, we had 66 on the House side sign on. Six of those were Republicans. On the Senate side, it was all Democrats, the six senators that signed on. And we have to get through the party issue and say, this is a human issue affecting veterans. And so with that, I hear our music coming up. We've had a delightful educational seminar today on Gulf War illness, particularly the hazard of having pulmonary embolism. People get educated, get informed. We're the National Progressive Radio that we bring these programs to you to alert you to problems with the veterans and what you can do about it. Get involved. Contact your representatives and your senators in D.C. We need to get answers. And with that, we move forward till next week.